Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The book is entitled Good Fridays. It's written by Eastern Shore author Diane Marquette. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The book centers around a drive from Denver to Baltimore and the relationship between Emily Carmichael and her mother. But along the way, there is a diary touching on her adoption and a long family history that takes the reader through a series of twists and turns for a final moment. And in studio is Diane Marquette, and welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you, Don.
And I'm going to have you set this up, but before we do, there's a quote that sort of caught my eye that sort of creates the suspense. It's in the early part of the book, and as we said, this is a drive that takes place between a daughter and a mother. And in the quote, it says, "My mother's known the truth all along. She just chose to ignore it and live her life the way it suited her. I can't stop thinking about all the lives she's affected with her selfish decision. My mother could have taken those secrets to her grave, but thank goodness I know the truth. Now all I need to do is confront her with it." And that's sort of one of the opening passages of the book. Set this up for us to what exactly is the truth here? What is it they're getting at as they drive down to Baltimore?
Well, Good Fridays is the story of Emily Carmichael, who kept diaries for seven decades about growing up in Baltimore, her career, her two marriages, the infant daughter she gave up for adoption, and her retirement to Maryland's Eastern Shore. And as the book begins, those diaries are about to reveal the secret that's going to change the relationship between the mother and the daughter, who are traveling from Denver to Baltimore for Emily's funeral. So as the story opens, the main character has already died. So the book spans the 1,500-mile trip, all three generations, and one life-changing secret. So it's the secret that you're alluding to. And Good Fridays is actually the story of how one person's decision, just one decision in their life, can affect so many other people. We're each faced with decisions every day. Most are minor, but some can be life-changing for us, as well as for those not yet born. And that's what Good Fridays is about.
So describe Emily Carmichael.
Mm-hmm. She's 86 years old. She was born and raised in Baltimore. And she lived through the Depression. She lived through Good Fridays. And those two events helped shape her life and make her the person that she became, and actually led to the decision that is going to change the lives of these other two women. Emily got married to a man who was going off to the service in World War II. They were married for 17 days. He was killed before he even left the country for the war. She found out she was pregnant. So she was a bride, a mother-to-be, and a widow in a very short period of time. She had a very domineering mother who had refused to even admit that her daughter was involved with this man, much less married. She treated the child that was subsequently born as though she didn't exist. And as Emily sank into a very deep depression, the domineering mother forced Emily to give the baby up for adoption.
How would you describe her mother? Because she seems like somebody who is very concerned about what people think. I mean, is there a certain rigidity, I think, to her mm-hmm. to her character?
Actually, I gave the mother in the story the mental disease of borderline personality disorder. The indicators for that are a sense of entitlement, a sense that they are never to blame for anything. Everyone else has to be held accountable. And they do not understand that it is their actions that actually achieve the results that everyone else has to live by. That's impossible. I know someone that has this. And it is amazing to think that there are millions of people walking around undiagnosed who are living seemingly normal lives. They're in family relationships. They have friends. They work. And we might look at those people on the outside and say, you know, he's very controlling, or she just has to always be right. And it might be nothing deeper than that, but it could be something as serious as this disorder. And the irony is, these people don't understand that it could be them.
Now, this seems to continue to play out. Describe the relationship then, as far as we know, as far as you want to go, in terms of you have the mother, you have Carmichael, and then, of course, we have, I think it's Sarah who's in the car, and she's sort of the youngest of the generation. How does this fit together as much as you?
Well, when Sarah, who is 30, and her mother, Vicky, who is 64, leave Denver to drive to Baltimore for Emily's funeral, all that Sarah knows at that point is that they used to live in Maryland and they knew Emily, but now they're going to her funeral. Sarah always thought a lot of Emily, but never realized the full extent of their relationship. Since Emily has recently died, Sarah, the younger girl, has received from Emily's attorney a large box containing excerpts of the diaries that Emily kept for 70 years. Now Sarah knows the truth. And those diaries also revealed the part that her mother, Vicky, played in keeping this secret from Sarah for Sarah's entire life of 30 years. Sarah is furious. Sarah knows that her mother's decision to keep this secret from her has greatly impacted her life. And now Emily's dead, and there's nothing that can be done to rectify that. Sarah has grown up with her mother, Vicky, knowing that she is a controlling person. She's domineering. She always blames Sarah for everything, never gives Sarah any credit. And Sarah finally is ready to stand up to her mother. This is the last straw. This secret is so life-changing, and I don't want to give it away.
Let me ask you this, though. Mm-hmm. That's great. Sarah's mother, mm-hmm, and Emily's mother, mm-hmm, they seem to have display the same kinds of characteristics, as it were. Yep. There's a certain irony here. I mean, mm-hmm, is that how you intended it?
Definitely. But until the reader understands the full impact of the secret, they're not going to connect the dots.
So what does that say about individuals like that, particularly in society? Is it just simply that they're shaped simply by their individual experiences? Do we know why, for instance, Emily was so controlling? Is there any sense about, you know, how that developed?
I believe it's both genetic and environmental. People who with borderline personality disorder, usually at the core of that is a fear of abandonment. So if you go back into someone's childhood far enough, you can put your finger on something that probably triggered that. But also it is, excuse me, genetic, because borderlines beget borderlines.
Also, there seems to be, both the women seem to be inhibited by the social views of the times. That you know, for instance, with Emily, certainly there was a certain amount. She was thinking about how what other people would think, for
mm-hmm,
example,
and always.
And certainly, Vicky seems to be the same way. I mean, there mm-hmm does seem to be the societal element involved with
definitely
this.
It's all about appearances. It's all about what people's perception is of them, and that's why they're so quick to blame other people. They want to look totally perfect. They want to look blameless. They want to look, you know, as pure as possible. And everyone else around them is wrong. And they actually believe that they are right and everyone else is wrong. It's an impossible personality to deal with, much less live with.
So how would you describe Sarah? I mean, what kind of impact has all this had on her? And it, throughout the book, you see this sort of emerging, mm-hmm, sort of rebellion, as it were, against the kinds of things that have been kept from her.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah's about to make a life change herself, because she has met a young man that she wants to marry. They live in Denver now, and of course her mother is there, and her mother has sort of run her life all along. But now Sarah wants to get married, and they want to move to Seattle. because he's going to be a psychiatrist and going to go into practice with a friend. Those are two huge bombs that she's going to have to drop on her mother, Vicki, anyway, and decided to use this trip. That's 5 days in the car with this woman each way. And she's her fiance, Ryan, has helped her get as strong as she can, given her as much mental ammunition as he can to help her try to finally divert this misbehavior that her mother's put on her all her life. So Sarah has already decided, even before she gets these diary pages from Emily, that came just a day or two before they were leaving on the trip, she had already decided she's got to tell her mother she's marrying, which that's abandoning her mother. I mean, she's not just getting married shouldn't make the mother feel abandoned, but they are moving to Seattle. That goes right to the heart of Vicki's problem, fear of abandonment. So Sarah had already decided to do those two things. Now she's got the diaries. Now she knows something huge that her mother is responsible for in her life that can never be changed. So that has just added fuel to the fire, and she is ready to go for it. Although every night she needs to talk to Ryan, her fiancé psychiatrist, to get re-bolstered for the next day to deal with her mother. And the underlying fact here is that you cannot change a borderline personality disorder sufferer. What you can do is only protect yourself. Try to limit the abuse by saying to that person, I can't talk to you when you're raging like this. We're not going to get anywhere. I will definitely discuss this a little later when you feel better. Right now, we're not going to get anywhere. Let's just decide to postpone this. That way, the sufferer doesn't feel like they're being abandoned or brushed off, but everyone knows they're not going to make any headway when the borderline personality sufferer is raging and just striking out and lashing out. They're not hearing anything. They're not receiving any information. They are just transmitting.
Do we see, and I was reading the book, do you think we see any change in her mother's personality at all through this entire trip? I mean, it doesn't seem as if, it seems as if her mother's right back to where they started from, and she, I think, towards the very, very end of the book, is saying, you know, enough is enough, and there's this determination to go on. But do we really see anything, any change in this 5-6 day trip there from her mother at all?
Not a change in the mother, because she can't change. First of all, she doesn't realize that she's a problem. So she doesn't realize that she needs to change. It's everyone else. So really the goal of the trip is for Sarah to save herself, Sarah to try to lay some groundwork for the rest of her life by just setting some boundaries for her mother to say, that is not my fault. You did such and such, and that's the result that we're seeing now. So it's not right to blame me. And if you continue screaming and raging like this, we can't discuss it right now, but we will later. And then Sarah needs to own up to that and leave the room. Sarah has been a punching bag for 30 years. So the purpose, and it's attainable, is for Sarah to save herself. And that's the groundwork that she's setting through this road trip. And she's trying to tell her mother that she's going to get married and she will be moving, but her mother will be fine. Sarah's not abandoning her mother. She's just stepping into the next phase of her life. She'll still be her daughter. But Sarah should not be held accountable for her mother's happiness.
Should I get a sense that if indeed all goes according to plan and she's married and she moves away, there's a good possibility that the separation between her and her mother may become very permanent. That is, that once she's gone, you say, well, she's not abandoning her, but on the other hand, the relationship may be just too difficult to continue.
Well, that may be a sequel. If enough readers want to know what happens next, that's when a writer knows that they've created believable characters, when you type the end, but then you're wondering what they're doing now, and the next week, and the next week. That's called a sequel, maybe a series. But who knows? Sarah's mother, Vicky, may transfer all of that hostility. Maybe she'll remarry. Maybe, you know, somebody else will be the lucky recipient of her behavior.
So what inspired you to write this particular book? I know you've been sort of famous for writing mysteries, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. right? But what inspired you to put this together?
Well, I think every book is a mystery, even if that's not the genre it's labeled with, but because we don't know how it's going to end. And in a story, you have to have somebody that you care about, even if you hate them, because then you want to see them get what's due. But in this case, I have three main characters, Sarah, and I think the readers can identify with her because she is put upon. There's definitely a nemesis in her life, and it has been for 30 years. And she's a good person. She really is. And I hope the reader gets a sense of that within the first few pages, that they really care about what's happening to her. Her mother, Vicky, is the problem. We'd like to see her change, but I explain the technical part of the psychology that she can't. She can't. Emily is the driving force behind all of this because it was Emily who did the original action back in the 1940s that is about to impact these women in the early 2000s on their trip from Denver to Baltimore. So what made me write this? The thing that makes me write any book, I start hearing voices. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I'm not living in the time of Joan of Arc, but because I wouldn't be writing, I'd be dead. But I start hearing people's tones and snippets of dialogue. And a story evolves because a second character will come in and their personality will, you know, become three-dimensional to me in my mind. And I always have the beginning, the middle, the end, and a few things in between when I sit down to write the story. I always know the end. What I don't know is how the characters are going to take me there. Because once I start developing the characters, they really do flesh out. And I may know where I want them to end at the chapter, but they might take a way that I didn't think they would.
Writing is a way to do that, by the way.
Yes, and to write and enjoy writing, it's just as exciting as reading the book because I never know exactly what's going to happen next. I know how it's going to end. I'm not sure how we're going to get there, but they'll take me.
Now, were any of these characters drawn from either people you knew or kinds of people that you knew or anything like that? Because a lot of people, for instance, when they write, I mean, they may not be writing about, say, individuals that they met, but mm-hmm. there are certain composites, there's certain mm-hmm. pieces of one person or another person, people they've met, or they may not only have only met once, that they didn't get incorporated into these. Any of that going on here?
I'm asked that a lot. I think most writers of fiction will say that they make up the characters, but they're definitely inspired by people that we know. And I've also heard it said, thank goodness, that people never recognize themselves in books. That's why there's a disclaimer up front, you know, no living person and all that, just purely coincidence. That's for good reason. But I think one person comes to mind. My mother-in-law lives in Baltimore. She's 90 and a half. Her name is Amelia Marquette. And not that she lived the same life as Emily, but she lived in the very same time period. Through the 20s and into the Depression, World War II had a bit of an impact on her. Her siblings were in the service. And I think knowing so much about her life gave me a nice roadmap for Emily's life. And I grew up in Baltimore, so I certainly know the landscape. I changed a few street names using street names I like. Maybe geographically they're not completely accurate, but a lot of the description of Baltimore and the surroundings is definitely accurate. And, of course, there's a good scene that takes place in Annapolis, and that's true to life. Talks about the State House and also Chestertown and Centerville and Catonsville. So write what you know.
Now, one of the things, by the way, Emily, talking about that period, she, of course, goes to work, I think it's for a department store, and sort of rises up the ranks. But she has to deal with a lot of the things that we think now are gone, though I think, suspect, not as much as we think. But nonetheless, that there is a difficult time asserting herself as a woman in this very male-dominated period in which you were expected to go up through the ranks. If you were to become a manager, for example, most men were the managers, not women. Describe that rise there.
Well, I think that's exactly the way it was, and unfortunately it's still the same way. But I remember in Baltimore, there were a handful of large department stores along Howard Street, Lexington Street, Hutzler Brothers, Stewart's, Heck Company, Hoshel Cohn, and that was the place to shop. There were no malls. There were no suburban shopping centers. So I remember vividly going down there, buying the Easter outfit and all of that. My mother worked at Hutzler's for many years, although not in management. But I know there really were the Hutzler brothers, and everything was run by the men, even the dress departments, which seems a bit absurd now, because people... buyers are the ones that get the material and the merchandise in the store. And I'm not sure what, a man in his 60s knows about the spring trends. But I saw a little bit of that as I was growing up and decided to give Emily that sort of a career. And she was very fortunate that she could have such a nice career, because she never attended college. And she got where she did through hard work. Plus, the man who owned the store, and his last name was Upman, which is my family's name. It was my mother's maiden name. Lots of Upmans in Catonsville. He was a good person, a very good person. And he really did see her potential and took her under his wing and helped her through her very difficult personal times, and as well as her professional path.
Now, I guess you have a blog, and I assume you're getting some feedback from readers. What kind of feedback? What's been the reaction to this from some of your readers?
Well, I know what my readers want. They do talk to me through Twitter, Facebook, all the social networks, right. And I have a website and I have the blog. So it makes it very easy to open up a line of communication with them. Readers like to know just the questions you're asking. How did you write this book? Where did you get the characters? Where did you get their names? Why did you pick the time that it takes place in, the past as compared to contemporary? And what I'm hearing from readers, they definitely like the books that I'm writing. And Good Fridays, I have a blog just about this book, and it talks about all those behind-the-scenes things. It talks about the story behind the story. And what I'm hearing is that this book in particular appeals to a very wide audience, men and women. Since there are the three main characters are all women, one would think this could be called a work of women's fiction, but men are enjoying it too. It also appeals to a wide age group, because the three characters, one's 30, one's 64, and one's 86. But I've had comments from teens and 30-somethings and boomers and seniors. So having a wide appeal is always a good thing for a book. I know what I like to write, and if I can tap into what readers want to read, then that's the best of both worlds. So I like to have this dialogue going with readers so I can continue giving them what they want to read.
By the way, to your readers there, both reading your mysteries, what's mm-hmm. considered traditional mysteries, and, mm-hmm. and then books like this, there's a lot of
definitely.
Crossover.
Definitely. I do a lot of book signings. I do a lot of other author events. And I always take, I have five books, actually, another book that is a work of women's fiction. But I have three mysteries in my Chesapeake Conference Center mystery series. I'm writing the fourth now. And I get a lot of feedback about that. Mysteries, I would say, is the most popular genre, the mystery genre. And having a series is great, because if you have someone who likes book number one, why wouldn't they continue with the series? It's also easier to write. You already have the main characters. You know their personalities. You know their tones. By book number four now, I know the protagonist, Jill McCormick, so well. I know what really scares her. I didn't in the beginning. I feel like every time I see her, and I say see, she shows up in my office every morning and sits on the sofa, and she wants to know if I'm going to work with her or if I'm still working with Emily and promoting Emily's story through Good Friday. Depends on the day, and Jill's becoming a little bit impatient. But I know everything about her now, and her her lover, who's the sheriff in the mystery series, he's developing. He is very popular. If he ever materialized, there would be a line of women waiting to meet him. He doesn't exist, but he is probably the most popular character in all my books. He's just catnip to people.
Well, that's one way to describe it, I guess, for your readers.
Uh-huh.
But you also have, and I've not read it, but I've noticed that you have another novel called Almost Mine, which is described as when a 30-year-old Helen Pratt marries Adam Montgomery, his teenage daughter Missy makes Helen's role as her stepmother a very difficult one. Helen and Adam desire to start a family of their own, but it's young Missy who becomes pregnant. Tell us a little bit about this novel. As I say, I have not read it. And what is it about?
It's Helen is of course first a bride. She knows though that she's also instantly a stepmother, which is okay with her. She respects the fact that Missy's father is the most important person in Missy's life. So Helen is happy to share Adam. He's her husband, but he's also Missy's father. Unfortunately, Missy is a brat. She's 18. She's spoiled. She immediately makes trouble between her father and Helen, and it doesn't stop. Helen and her husband Adam want to start a family of their own, but then Missy is the one who gets pregnant by her boyfriend. So suddenly, Helen knows she's not going to be a mother. What she's going to be is a step-grandmother. Missy is going to have a child. That's Helen's stepdaughter is going to have a child. What does that make Helen? There is a word for it, a step-grandmother. And that's a very hot topic now. With so many blended families, with so many people on multiple marriages, and so many boomers, you know, they have two sets of kids, stepchildren and their own children, who are now having children. So the families are blended in more ways than ever before. So step-grandparenting is a very, very hot topic right now. And this is what poor Helen has to deal with, becoming a step-grandmother before she even gets to be a mother herself. She's only 30.
Okay, we've been talking with Diane Marquette, author of Good Fridays. And I think you have a book signing. What day is that?
That's going to be on Saturday, March 31st in Easton at the News Center from 10 till 2. I'll be signing copies of Good Fridays and all of my other books as well.
We've been speaking with author, Eastern Shore author Diane Marquette, her new book, Good Fridays. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on Pack 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pack14.org.